The next presentation is kind of the prophetic background in America, and we happen to see, I was doing some work on the Knights Templar and the Freemasons, just to go over their history of how the United States becomes America's spiritual destiny. And then in some of Shoghi Effendi's writings, he talks about how the destiny of the United States is tied up with the destiny of the Baha'i Faith and the coming of the Most Great Peace. And he talks about how the history of the cause and the history of the United States is tied together. So we've already kind of seen this, that the Baha'i epochs in Baha'i history, Shoghi Effendi divides it into the Heroic Age, then the Iron Age, and then the Golden Age for the faith. And the first epoch of the Iron Age is basically from 1921, the passing on of Abdu'l-Bahá, until about 1944. And so that basically covers the period between World War I and World War II. And then things fell apart within the faith. But if you look at the goals that were met, the second epoch is pretty much the entire time between 41 and 91, which is the entire Cold War period, the end of World War II, all the way until the Gulf War. And then between the Gulf War and the 9/11, the United States started to emerge as this new world order. When did George Bush announce the New World Order? Was that 91? Did he give a speech on September 11th, 1990?
I think it was 1994.
Yeah. So then the move against Iraq, was the implementation of this. And then it kind of comes to fruition with the 9/11, and this military machinery is put into place globally. And now we have an excuse to be at war all the time against a shadow enemy that you can't really put your finger on. And whether these people are actually blowing things up and causing problems, or we decide to use subterfuge to blow up things for our own purposes, like you were saying, hit them high, hit them low, hit them low, hit them high, you know, that mechanism's in place. So, what was I talking about before this? So I was looking into these prophecies. Then we happened to see they made another Dan Brown movie called Angels and Demons, which was a book that he wrote before The Da Vinci Code. But he's written another one, which you probably heard of, which is The Sign and the Seal. And he starts to get into the Masonic symbols and connections at the founding of the United States. And I guess Colin had pointed this out before, but I didn't remember it or didn't register with me. But you can, the city of Washington's laid out where they have these different geometric patterns, like a five-pointed star and certain Pythagorean 3, 4, 5 right triangles. And the most important one, they said, out of all of this imagery that they can draw in the cityscape, and I might get these wrong, is between the White House, the Jefferson Memorial, and then the Washington Monument. And I think, I had to look on a map, but I think the Washington Monument's at the high peak of the triangle, forms a right triangle, like 3, 4, 5 or something. Mm. And on a certain date of the year, it's only on a certain day, the three stars exactly align above Washington to those three points. And the stars are on the bottom line. The bottom two is... what was the other one?
Spica.
Yeah, Spica, Regulus, and then Arcturus. And all of a sudden it came to my mind, probably from what Colin had pointed out before, but those were the stars that we were talking about, where Spica is the star in Virgo, the Virgin, and then Regulus is the star in Leo, the Lion. And I remember you asking me for feedback about that before you went up to the Dreamtime, now that I think about it. Hmm. And I think I remember to just tell you to do whatever you thought it was, you know. And then the other one is Arcturus. And so, anyway, the two stars, Spica and Regulus. Regulus is one of the four... Regulus? Yeah. Regulus is one of the four foundation stars of the four corners that the pyramid of Enoch's temple, or the Great Pyramid, was founded on. The other stars are Aldebaran and Antares. Are form a cross, and they're originally for spring and fall, and then the summer one, summer solstice star was Regulus, and then the winter solstice star was Fomalhaut, which is below the constellation of Aquarius. So Regulus is the lion, or Leo, And then the face of the man is Aquarius, and then the bull or the calf is Taurus, and then Scorpio or the eagle with eagle's wings is Scorpio. And so those are the four beast countries that become the four living creatures. And the Regulus star is symbolic of the lion of the tribe of Judah, which represents, Colin was saying, Baha'u'llah being the king of kings that's seated on the throne of David. And the Christians know that the Virgin, Virgo, and that star, they relate it to the virgin birth of Jesus, you know, being this, you know. And then Arcturus is the shepherd star. Well, the actual name for Spica in the ancient language, in the Arabs, they called that star Tzimak. And Tzimak was the branch that's used in Zechariah. Behold, I bring forth my servant the branch. That word for branch in Arabic or Hebrew is Tzimak. And this is where the word Spica is related to it. And that prophecy doesn't refer to Jesus that was of Nazareth, because he wasn't seated on the throne or of the throne line. But it refers to the coming of the kingdom. So they can't understand this because they think, the Christians also think, the Regulus in the lion should refer to Christ the King, which is Jesus Christ. So because they have Jesus of Nazareth being the fulfillment of all of the prophecies in the Bible, they don't accept the prophecies where Muhammad is named, or the Bab, or Baha'u'llah, or Joshua the high priest. They think all of these things should refer to Jesus on his first coming, and they can't see through this. Well, in the book of Revelations, it also mentions a maiden. And it says that she was given the wings of an eagle, and that the dragon came after her child. She gave birth to this male child, and she fled into the wilderness for a time, two times, and half a time. And in Doc's explanation of Revelation, he talks about the time, two times, and a half a time being the 70 years, or the 70 years period between 1921 and 1991. And the woman is the maiden that Baha'u'llah saw in the vision. When he was in the Sea of Kal, he said that the Holy Spirit came unto him like a maiden. And so this is really Virgo, is the bride of the New Jerusalem, it says, will descend like a bride adorned for a husband. But the fact that they were Christian, they some of them Catholic, they tied Virgo in with the Virgin Mary and this type of stuff. Whereas it's prophetical in the book of Revelation, where it says there'll be this virgin bride dressed in white that descends as a bride adorned for a husband. And so they know that the that this King of Kings, symbolized by the line of the tribe of Judah, that this is who they see as the husbandman. So this is Baha'u'llah, the manifestation, and then the New Jerusalem, where the law of God is represented by Virgo. And so through the revelation of this covenant that Baha'u'llah gave, we have the universal house of justice, which is to be the successor, and the dragon being a symbol of the twisted intellect. And if you look in that part of the sky where the constellations are, there's a serpent constellation, or like a type of a dragon in that area. It said it pursued the woman, and this is the covenant breakers that, of course, tried to do away with the covenant of Baha'u'llah and the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá. So when they broke the covenant, this came to the United States between 1921 and 1991, and then it's born into the world as that first international Baha'i Council, or that House of Justice. And then by 2001, with He Brings Forth the Branch, this is the word Tzimak, so we're able to recognize the true House of Justice from fakes, frauds, and imitations. And so somehow the people that built Washington, D.C. were directly aware of the relationship between those prophecies in the Book of Revelation and the fact that this country had been designated to be the spot where this House of Justice would be established. Hey, Jeff. Hey, Jen. So one of the things that they haven't explained yet, I don't know why, and I first got into this when it was kind of like not that known, because I was reading and researching into some of this stuff back in the 1980s. It wasn't that popular. Dan Brown has really popularized this stuff. And that movie National Treasure starts off with the Knights Templar leading into the Masons, leading into the United States. And so now Dan Brown, who had focused on the Knights Templar and the lineage of Jesus thing, is taking the Knights Templar into the United States with his current book. And they're going to make him another movie with Tom Hanks in it for three of them. And that's supposed to be released in 2012. So I doubt I'm going to read Dan Brown's book, but whatever. Anyway, one of the things I noticed when I was interested in researching Ezekiel's temple, I read the last nine chapters of the book of Ezekiel, chapters 40 through 48. He divides up the land in there. And he says to divide it into 12 parts, one for each of the tribes, from the ocean to the mountains. See, so they just take the coastline and just cut it into 12 even pieces and bring it over. And then he says in the holy place, you want to cut that out. And you want to have it in the form of the square. And then he cuts the holy place out in the form of the square. And then that's where Ezekiel's temple is to be built. And Ezekiel, in his vision, he sees these four living creatures. And he sees the wheel within a wheel. So they have this idea of this wheel. So when you look at the original, this is why you see these 13 colonies. You've got these 12 or 13 stripes as colonies cut out. Basically Maine, New York, you know, coming out like this, basically, in the same scheme that Ezekiel has. And then Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia is cut out as a perfect 10-mile square. And then Washington itself, the streets are made as a grid pattern, but the city circular also. And so they made Washington as a circular city like a wheel. And when they built Detroit, they did it the same way as a wheel. And Moscow was laid out as a wheel. And that's why they were making these cities with a city center with concentric rings coming out from around them, because they were aware of these prophecies to make their capital cities like a wheel within a wheel. And this is why Washington, did you ever wonder why Washington was cut out of all the other, it's not part of any of the states. It's its own district of Columbia, whatever that means. Columbia supposedly has some other legal meaning to it altogether that has nothing to do with the United States. It has something to do with some maritime law or something like this. It's like a not considered, it's some sort of international or multinational entity, or I don't know.
Well, Washington, D.C. is considered to be a maritime district.
That's what it is, a maritime.
From which maritime issues can be adjudicated.
Yeah, explain that.
Administered.
So it's not really a state, it's a maritime district, right?
Yeah, it was mainly for the administration of insurance and stuff like salvage. That kind of thing, but
so it's not a state.
No, it's not supposed to be.
What is a mayor of Washington?
It's got these states like Puerto Rico, American Samoa, Virgin Islands, and so on.
Those are all maritime districts.
Well, they're all attached to this maritime district.
Oh,
yeah, they're not part of the United States proper. The United States proper, the 50 states, according to my understanding, and this could be wrong, is that the federal district was created for the benefit of the 50 states, so that they could they'd have representation on the seas in insurance, that kind of thing.
And that's why they made one of the reasons they made Washington as a maritime district.
That's my understanding, yeah. And so the 50 states are like 50 separate countries.
Right.
And they're united through this maritime district that is a servant of the 50 states.
Right.
It's not, but it's flip-flop now, so that the federal district dominates the 50 states. But now there's this secessionist effort going on in the United States, where 22 states at least are making laws to protect themselves against this maritime district, and saying that they're not going to go along with any of the federal.
This insurance thing is kind of fitting into it. I read one of the states was going to protect its citizens from not having to buy insurance within the state.
Right. Well, there's more than one now.
Which one was that? Massachusetts? Probably not.
It could have been
Maryland, Rhode Island, something like that. Something in New England, like yeah.
Yeah, but there are quite a few of them now
that
are making moves in that direction.
Now, New Hampshire actually had a warrant for the arrest of Bush and Cheney during the Gulf War. Had they gone in there? What?
What state?
Where is Lou from?
Vermont?
Yeah, Vermont had a law that if they would have went in there, they would have arrested them. So they never went into that state during their entire presidency because of that. So the states still have some sort of autonomy, but they're under repression.
Right. Yeah, and they could be attacked by the UN ultimately.
Oh, right.
For doing that.
So when they set this up, maybe they did it originally to benefit the states as a maritime, would you say a maritime district? Yeah, it's under a different type of law, but I always wondered why did they cut it out as the square? They didn't even address this. It's right out of the book of Ezekiel. If you read the last 9 chapters, you read about these tribes, these 12 tribes that each get land, and then how the holy place where Ezekiel's temple is to be built is in this square, you know, and then the cities are to be designed like a circle, like Washington and Detroit were. But anyway, I think that even though they did that, this shows that this was on their mind, that they seemed to have some idea of what they were up to, because in Pennsylvania, where they did the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they did that in Philadelphia, which is the city of brotherly love. But Philadelphia in the Bible is of the 7 churches, the one that's right with God. The other ones are half good, half bad. Some are all good, bad. The only one that's all good is the Church of Philadelphia. So why is that city called Philadelphia? And why did they meet in Philadelphia out of all the cities to do this? Well, this is from the 7 churches. And then they named the slogan of that state the Keystone State. And if you read the chapter in the book of Revelations on Philadelphia, it says this: they have the key of David. And then on the back of the dollar bill, you see the sign of the Star of David on the pyramid and on the other place. And the Jefferson Memorial that lines up this alignment wasn't built until the time of FDR. That it was the missing point in their triangle, but they'd had it marked on their blueprint since the founding of the country, but it's in the water. So they had to artificially fill in what river is in Washington? The Chesapeake?
The Potomac.
They had to artificially fill in. They had to do a landfill on that part in order to put the Jefferson Memorial in that corner of the triangle to make this stellar alignment. And the fact that it wasn't done until FDR was in office shows that this is a cohesive plan that they had from the founding of the country all the way up until then. We know FDR even accepted Baha'u'llah. So this comes to this part of the presentation that I wanted to talk about, which is the Masonic orders and secret societies that are believed, like in the Dan Brown book or the Knights Templar and these things, to be orchestrating things behind the scenes. And who is actually doing this? What are their motives? And where are their allegiances? Now, one of the problems we see with this is that it gets into the idea of esoteric knowledge or secret teachings, some sort of spirituality that's secret. So I'm just going to mention the Dan Brown stuff because they're popular at this point. So I don't really care. I'm glad that he's popularizing them. But in the Angels and Demons thing, for example, the main character winds up saving the Catholic Church. And whereas the Illuminati is supposed to be this group that's behind destroying the Catholic Church, in Dan Brown's story, it's just a crazy priest that scares everybody into thinking the Illuminati is existent, but they're defunct, to try to threaten the church into doing the things that he wants, and then the evil priest is exposed and put to death. So, warning, plot spoiler, you know. So in that story, the Illuminati actually doesn't exist. It's just this priest has spooked the church to a certain point and hired a hitman to kill off certain people in a certain pattern to make them think that it's there so he can, like, take over. And then he's exposed, so then there is no Illuminati, and lo and behold, the Catholic Church saved. Hooray, things can stay the way they are. Thus his first book, Angel and Demons, that nobody cared about. Then he wrote 2 or 3 other books, and then the 3rd or 4th one was The Da Vinci Code. And that one crossed the threshold, finally, into the pop culture, and it projected. So now he's projected. They saw how National Treasure did so good. He then wrote the next book after he was projected, which is this one that's coming out, The Sign and the Seal. And this one might be the best of all 3 of them. I had trouble with the second movie, which is the earlier book, when we watched it, because, you know, it was the way it's done. It's like, well, you know, what's really... Oh, that they had a few comments that were good on one hand, but bad on the other hand. And what they were saying is, in the movie, there's 2 scenes, and that's further from the book. He says, you know, well, one guy says to him, he says, look, I want to know if you believe in God. And then he starts huffing and puffing around, beating around the bush. And he says, I don't mean if you believe in what men say about God. I want to know if you believe in God. So I thought that was good, because what he was saying is, I don't mean if you're religious. And he said, religion is what men say about God.
Mm-hmm.
So that's different than what's actually happening about God. So I thought that was an interesting distinction. So then at the end, the next cardinal or the priest or whatever says to the main character, Langdon or Tom Hanks, he says something like, well, although God is perfect, our religion is imperfect. And what they mean is that their religion, because of what he said earlier, is that the religion is their understanding of God. So obviously our understanding of God is imperfect, so therefore our religion's imperfect. In other words, let's cut the church a bunch of slack, you know? And so what we really see is that God is perfect, and the revelation that's given from the manifestations is infallible. So our religion is infallible, and it's perfect. Our understanding of the religion, I agree with that part of it, was imperfect. But in their case, their religion's imperfect, because it's what men say about God. Our religion that we have, the Baha'i faith, isn't faith, but it's not a blind faith. It's a faith based on proof. Our religion isn't what we say about God. So our religion is a revelation from God about what God has to say about God. See? And so our faith, the Baha'i faith, is an infallible faith that's a religion based on proofs. And all of our understandings of that revelation are imperfect compared to the revelation itself. However, Abdu'l-Bahá says that when we make our choice, we leave the world of perfections and we enter the world of perfection, and that there's no end to perfections. So from that standpoint, the same way God made us with free will, we make mistakes, you know. But if we took away our free will, so we would never make a mistake. Doc said, would your life be perfect if you didn't have any free choice? He said, what would it be like? And everybody always answered when they thought about it, well, you'd be like a robot. And he said, will that be perfect? They'd be like, no. He says, therefore, our imperfection, our free will, is the cause of our perfection. We're imperfectly perfect. So when we enter into this understanding of this, we leave the world of imperfection and we enter the world of perfection. And this is the place where the religions of man have mucked up the whole thing, that they want to keep the world in the state that it's in. And they do this by keeping people out of the world of perfection. If the people could see the perfection in the religion, the true religion of God, and in the revelation, this would imbue onto them. And then they'd see the part of themselves that is within the world of perfection. And then this, they'd become, you know, imperfectly perfect. And when they would become satisfied by this. They would become happy in their own skins. They'd become satisfied with their karma or destiny or, you know, winning their station, or however you want to put it. And these wars would stop. If life had a purpose, it would become valuable. And then they wouldn't want to waste their time doing certain things when they could use that valuable time to do other things. And what a waste of time to diet and eat right and exercise and go to boot camp and learn how to break somebody's neck, you know. What a waste of time. Okay. Now, the reason we have to have an army is because the other nation is training people to diet and exercise and break people's necks and shoot and stuff. So now we have to have an army to defend ourselves against the other people's army. And according, I don't know if this is true or not, but I saw a documentary on chimpanzees today. And according to this documentary, the only other species in the world that does this is this certain type of chimpanzee. And the chimpanzees live in their little group, and then they have a territory. And every day, the certain group of male chimpanzees get up in a group of like 9 or 10 in single file, like they're marching in an army. They patrol the perimeter of their territory, where all the babies and women are like in the center of that. And they have a perimeter that they patrol this. You see them marching around like they're great apes, you know. And I was watching this going, oh my God. So then they'll actually live next door to another group of chimpanzees. And they're doing the same thing. They have this setup, and then they patrol the perimeter. Okay? And if the chimpanzees catch a female chimp or a baby chimp in they're at the perimeters overlap a little bit. So there's like these, they're not really DMZs, they're more like MZs, you know. They're like battle zones where they overlap. Then they catch them, they find these dead chimps. and they're crucified. The chimps will hold down the other chimp, and the group of them will grab their hands and legs and spread them apart, and then one of them will jump on top and beat them to death. And they'll rip off their genitalia and throw it away, and they're very violent, you know. And they'll rip their limbs off and stuff like this, and they find them like they've been crucified, these corpses of these other chimps. If they find a baby chimp, they'll kill it and eat it. And in the DMZ area, whatever you want to call that, you know, the where these, and this, they do this. And they're the only other species, according to this documentary, on Earth. No other species does this. And they seem to take great satisfaction and pleasure in heinous acts of violence against their own species in this type of a way. They become satisfied with this, is the word they use. Jeez. And the only other group that they've seen on the planet that does this is the human being.
Right.
And I think in Abdu'l-Bahá's tablets, he says the animals don't do this, just the human being does it. And this is one of the greatest arguments in observational science, that the chimpanzee and man are, you know, were maybe once the same species. And not different. So what they want to do now, they have all these species we've been talking about at the last bunch of forums, is they want to elevate the chimpanzees that do this. They're chimpanzees. So they're called, their species is called pan something or other. Whereas human beings are like Homo erectus, Homo sapien. So chimpanzees are like pan something. And then another type of chimpanzee is pan something. And then the orangutan, I wish she was up, she could tell us, is they've got another name, you know. Anyway, one of the groups of chimpanzees, I think this one that we're talking about is the troglodyte. And I just think that's absolutely hilarious for me, because if you called somebody a troglodyte, it kind of meant they were like lower than a caveman. Like if you say somebody's a Neanderthal, that kind of suggests they're like a primitive form of man. But a troglodyte suggests subhuman. See, a troglodyte was the subhuman. So they wanted... Yeah, well, no, they have Neanderthal as a caveman, and then troglodyte was even below caveman.
Oh, okay.
Well, apparently these chimpanzees are called pan-troglodyte.
Hmm.
That's their technical name. And they want to change their name, she was telling me, to Homo troglodyte. They want to elevate them into the, you know, but what they should do, maybe, is take people who behave like this and change them to be pan-sapien.
There you go.
Were you saying that earlier? Yeah. We were joking about that. And then if they accept God and are spiritual, then they could be Homo sapien. And Baha'u'llah actually has a tablet about this that I was reading. It was previously untranslated. And he says something like, not all human beings are human, but if they stand before God, they become human, or something like this. I don't know what it says in the original language. But it's something to the effect that what makes us human is our spirituality, our spiritual qualities and attributes. So we have something different. Now, one of the science magazines that I have, they were suggesting that the chimpanzee may have originally been, because they're so close to the humans in behavior, and in their genetics, they are 98% similar in the that one area of DNA, not the other part, that they may have actually been we may have been a common species, and that for some reason the one group changed its behaviors and evolved into something more, and the other group refused to go along with the program and like devolved until the point that they're so different they can't intermingle.
Mm-hmm.
But they might latently have the power to think in the abstract, but because of what they did, their frontal lobe didn't develop. And now we can no longer crossbreed with them. So it's possible that there is some sort of commonality there. Science might flesh this out more. And science has already made some of these discoveries. The Science magazine was suggesting that these are devolved human beings. And that got me thinking, well, wait, what if it's true? You know, we just don't want to be indoctrinated and dogmatic to the point that we're not going to accept this. I remember in the Purpose of Life fireside, people always bring up when we said that human beings can think in the abstract and animals can't. They go, what about the dolphins? You know? And somebody asked Doc this. And he says, well, what do you mean? He says, well, they have a high forehead. They think they're telepathic. And they probably think in the abstract. You know? And he says, look, if they think in the abstract, then they're human. his definition of animal was they didn't think in the abstract. Mm-hmm. So if they think in the abstract, they're in the human kingdom. It didn't matter if they looked like a dolphin. And if it's not our fault if we can't communicate with them. Obviously, if we can communicate with them and we find out they think in the abstract, we can't be prejudiced. See? So that those people immediately accepted. They're like, oh, okay. So then we moved on. Well, these monkeys don't exactly think in the abstract. But suppose it's latent, and like they could later, or maybe they did, but now they don't, you know? You look at people that have Down syndrome and other things in our species, you know, and they're different genetically. Well, how far can some, in other words, how far can somebody be genetically different? Then we look at these other people, they're giants. They're like 8 feet tall. Then other people, like Mini-Me, I don't know his name, he's kind of small. See? Mm-hmm. Well, suppose there was thousands and thousands of people just like him. Well, obviously they're human, you know, I'm not putting him down that way, but I'm just saying physically he's a different size or shape, see? So we don't know. And then what about the dog face boy? Remember those people? They have, it's a certain condition they have on their genetics. They're totally covered in hair. Mm. They have to shave their face, their nose. You ever see these people? Mm. They look just like Chewbacca. Mm. Ah, and they're in Mexico. There's a very famous pair of these boys. You can look them up on the internet. We don't completely understand this scientifically. So then Colin has come across some interesting recent scientific articles that I'd like to at least mention. We can document them later. But what was the first one was based on choices. And the second thing is based on choice-based DNA. And the second thing is word-activated DNA. So why don't you tell us about the choice-based DNA thing? That was in what magazine was that in?
The first one was in Time magazine like 2 months ago.
Yeah, we got to get a copy of this.
I have it at the house, and I was going to bring it, but I didn't.
That's okay.
But
we'll scan it and stuff.
Yeah, basically they've been, I can't remember the gist of it now because it's been a couple of weeks, but basically they were figuring out that certain genes could be turned on and off by the parents before they had the kids. And that if they had certain behaviors at certain times in their life, that it would cause certain genes to be, what's the opposite of recessive? Dominant?
Active, dominant. Active,
dominant. So like if they had certain behaviors at certain times in their life, and then they had kids, then those children born during that time would have certain genes dominant and certain ones recessive, and then other kids born from the same parents during a different set of circumstances would have other genes dominant. And so the way that they figured this out was like there were certain famines and then certain times of abundance in the Scandinavian countries. Yeah. And that they found that children that were born during the abundance tended to be born during a time of gluttony in their parents. And then they would inherit all of these negative genetic attributes where they would die several years younger. They would be more obese. They would have more problems in their life. And so certain negative qualities would become dominant in their genes. And then other kids that were born during a famine type of a scene would actually be born more robust, and they would be less gluttonous, and they would live longer, and they would be healthier, and they would perform better on IQ tests and stuff like this. And so they did all of these studies, and at the end of the day they figured out that it had to do with this idea that the genes could be activated or deactivated through the behaviors of the parents. And that this would actually sometimes last through multiple generations.
Now, the reason that this caught my ear is about 20 years ago or so, I gave in a presentation. Somebody asked why the Octus was revealed to men. Because if you read it, it's addressed to the men. It's not addressed to the women. But the women are included. So what I explained is that the men make DNA every day. Every morning a man gets up and he's got a whole new crew ready to swim upstream. The sperm is made every day. But the women are born with all of their eggs from birth in their ovaries. So if a woman is making choices and behaving during their life, it's not going to affect the genetic material that's in those eggs because she has those eggs from birth. But a man is making the seed every morning. So it occurred to me that based on the choices of the way a man lives his life, he's going to be encoding and not encoding the males of the species. The DNA is going to be formed different each morning, especially if there's certain patterns over years. You imagine the body will just come, you know, it's an information based. that I thought this was based on choices to a certain extent. And so what would happen is that when a man and a woman come together, the man's thing is changing, the woman's inherited everything she has, that the offspring is going to be different. Well, if it's a girl, you see what I mean? She will have inherited the variations from her father. But the if it's a boy, he will have inherited not only the variations from the father, but make his own variations. And then this could last, Moses says, in the case of idolatry, of praying to statues, 3 or 4 generations, then it goes away. It reverts back to its natural state. But if wrong choices are deliberately being made, this could last for 3 or 4 generations, but then it reverts to its natural state when it comes to understanding the invisible God concept, at least. I don't know about other behaviors. So that doesn't last forever. So what the ovums are doing, the egg is bringing stability to the species, because the woman's inherited this. And then the male seed is bringing modification to more of an extent than the egg, you know. And so I thought this was interesting because it confirmed this idea. But what I was looking at it from the perspective of that the choices we make are based on the coming of the manifestation. So this other Science News article that I read got me thinking when I read that, which was before he came up with this, that these people were disobeying the manifestations of their day. The manifestations come, let's say, in the time of Mu or Lemuria, and they're like, look, this is how you write, you know, we're going to learn how to read and write, you know. Well, obviously, if you're reading and writing, your brain is going to evolve. Now, they thought that our brains didn't evolve, but in the year 2000, they saw an adult grow a new neuron under a microscope. They were all excited because we got a new synapse. They'd never seen that. They thought we'd just born with so many and they just keep dying. So this shows that we evolve, and then this gets passed down. So we just weren't always had a big frontal lobe, that this is the seat of the intellect, and our intellect grows in layers. Like we go to first grade, second grade, third grade. If each generation does what it's supposed to under in the school of God through the manifestations, it learns a lesson. The next generation is like second grade. You know, it's an upgrade. Like, the computers keep improving. They go from 2.1 to 3, and what version of Windows are we on now?
7.
So, ostensibly, 7's better than 5. it improves. It doesn't. You don't want to buy 7 if it's worse than 6, which I think people hated that Vista because they said it was worse than XP. Mm-hmm. But now I heard that they have something even better than both, supposedly. Everybody's happy with it. So these are like the grades in school. For instance, if we learn calculus, this is based on algebra, and trigonometry, which is based on learning to multiply, multiplication is based on addition, and addition is based on counting, and counting is based on reading, to recognize that. And it's progressive. You can't just learn calculus, and it takes years to master these sciences based on progressive grades of knowledge. So the manifestations are sent down progressively, and they give us this. And I can just see a group of humans from a previous cycle and the manifestation giving this teaching, and people like the sons of Korah that wouldn't obey Moses in recent history being like, look, we're not going to go along with this. You know, we want to just continue to swing from the trees and throw crap at each other. And the manifestation's like, now listen, if you keep smoking that stuff and eating the fruit that's rotten, it's, you know, that gets you all dizzy and stuff, you're not going to evolve into the program here. And they're like, well, we like to eat the rotten fruit in the jungle that's been in the sun because it makes us all buzzed. We like to do these things, you know. We're not going to learn how to read and spell and be in civilization. And so you could see how there could be this divergence. And as these people continue to, as somebody once said, crap flingers and tree climbing crap flingers or whatever.
Crap flinging tree dwellers.
There you go. That's exactly what they are. They're pan-troglodyte, according to the Science News. And look at the punishment for not listening to a manifestation a few cycles ago.
Yeah.
You know? Now, look, Freud wrote Civilization and its Discontents. So in other words, there's discontents in civilization. And I was complaining about them in the first part, you know, like, what's the cost-benefit ratio to being in civilization? Well, I don't want to be a, you know, pan-troglodyte, you know. So I think that humanity, and I think that this happens when the universal manifestations come at the end of the cycles, at the junction of the universal cycles, these are very important choices. Maybe even more significant and important than like if a Christian didn't accept Muhammad and then their descendants stayed in Christianity. Well, they could still accept the Bab and Baha'u'llah. Or Jews that didn't accept Jesus and Muhammad, they could, you know, they could still are civilized within the cycle. But those people that were like in Atlantis that refused to accept Adam, or before that, they were in Mu that refused to accept the one that came when the chain cycles to Lemuria. This is probably where we're seeing, you know, the pan troglodyte type human Homo sapien Homo erectus divisions. It could be at those junctures. That's the juncture we live at today. We live at the close of a universal cycle. The Adamic cycle's over. The Mayan calendar brings it to an end in 2012, and we move into a new cycle. And we're seeing, you know, a really dramatic difference in not just phenotype and genotype, but in like personality type, or I don't know what word to ascribe to it, between the way certain people are behaving. Certain people are hoarding money and being extremely greedy. They're not humanitarian. They don't have spiritual qualities and attributes. They're warmongering. They're so bad at this that people like David Icke and others are convinced they're eighth dimensional lizards. That, and according to some biological theory of different types of brains, mammalian and then human is the intellect, then mammalian animal brain, and then we have the reptile brain, which is just this cold-blooded, not caring, it doesn't have a conscience type survival system, like a dinosaur brain, like they think a chicken has a reptile brain. They're vicious. And that's why they've used this imagery. Well, the intellect is symbolized by the serpent too, but when it's turned away from God, it becomes the twisted intellect. And so that these people have reckoned this as a race of Satans that are basically reptilian for some reason or another in their nature. Well, this is probably more pronounced now than it, although it was there in the Adamic cycle, because of the brightness of the light of the revelation of Baha'u'llah today, whether they know who Baha'u'llah is or not, these qualities that he's announced are prevalent as the criteria for morality and immorality. Now it's morality is the oneness of humanity. Immorality is racism and Hitlerism and these things. Morality is we should have the right to see the truth with our own eyes. Immorality is to indoctrinate people and foist people into error. Morality is that men and women should have equal rights. Okay? Immorality is the repression of women. Now, when did these things become the standard of morality and immorality? 150 years ago, those things weren't the standard of morality and immorality. Nation state was important. The Brits are the master race. You know, they're the chosen people, or the other ones are the chosen people. And because it's might makes right, because we're the chosen people, we have the right to dominate. That's the thinking behind the Treaty of Westphalia, and international law is whatever country's the strongest that wins the war, won because God was on their side. There's no oneness of humanity there. Equality of men and women? Women didn't even get the right to vote till 1920s. The suffragette movement, there's no equality of men and women. Women serve man. Man was superior. Independent investigation of truth? Hell no. We're the upper class. That's our station. You're the lower class. That's your station. You work for us. We go to our colleges. We send you to guild schools so you can build us a brick house better. There's no equality or seeing the truth with your own eyes there. And the religion was used not as to progressively free the people, and there was no spiritual solution to the economic problem, none of these things. So 150 years ago, none of these things were en vogue or the standard. But today they are, like the United Colors of Benetton. Why? Well, we happen to realize that there was a manifestation that came that closed the cycle and ushered in the new one, even though the majority of people don't recognize that. These are still the standards of morality. This is the power of the manifestation, even when unknown or unseen by the people. So these manifestations are the men of the unseen. In other words, Jesus walked amongst the people, but they didn't recognize who he was. He went unseen while he walked amongst them.
He didn't even occur to them.
No. When he finally asked people who they thought he was, nobody knew who he was. Peter finally said he was the promised one, the descendant of David the Christ. They didn't know. When Muhammad walked amongst the people, he was a man of the unseen. They thought he was just another sorcerer reading spells out of the greater key of Solomon like the Jews were. This is in the Quran in the Surah of the Cow, chapter 2, verse 102. It mentions this. And they accused Baha'u'llah of palpable sorcery. So these people are unrecognized, that they come into our world in the human temple with a message from God, and they are the independent divine revelators. Well, now we're at this crossroads where we're going to merge into this other cycle. And one of the things that Muhammad mentions in the Quran is he mentions different orders of being. He says that God made angels, and then the demons, or the jinn, and then human beings. And in the Quran, he says that these angels don't have free will. They are God's servants. They can only carry out the will of God. They can't say no. So they're without sin because they're a different order. He says, now the jinn, which is where we get the word genie from, and the human being, he says, this is different. The jinn can choose to do right or wrong, to obey or disobey God. And the human being can choose to do right or wrong, to obey or disobey God. And then he says, now the jinn are made out of smokeless fire. And then he says, and you're human beings, you're raised up from a little drop of goo.
Smokeless fire.
Yeah. So this has baffled the Muslims and the students of the Quran for hundreds of years since it was revealed. They disagree theologically now with Christians that teach Satan's a fallen angel. Because if Satan was originally an angel, he wouldn't have had free will. He couldn't have disobeyed God. And in the Quran, Muhammad says Iblis is a jinn made of smokeless fire. He's not an angel.
Iblis?
Yeah, Satan. Iblis. That's what they call him. They think that comes from Diablos. Iblis has something to do with that. They think those words are related. Iblis and devil and Diabla. See, Iblis. Okay, so one of the things that we know is that this word jinn, okay, is related to our word gene. And this is where we get our genius, is from our genes, or the genie. And our genes are composed of smokeless fire, that they're made of four substances, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. And these things are, and that's a translation from the Arabic, but the exact Arabic he uses is how the genes are formed in the four bases that form the two base pairs of our DNA is created out of smokeless fire from these four elements that we've been talking about that correspond to the four letters of the name of God. And so our genes are activated and deactivated, dominant, recessive, based on our choices. So our genes, through our own will, can go against the will of God. Now, when we see that our genes might be against God's will, then we choose to be in favor of God's will and have to subdue those genes. And so human beings can also choose to go against the will or not. And this is what Muhammad is really getting at. And when he says angel, he doesn't mean a person that has spiritual qualities and attributes, that type of angel. Abdu'l-Bahá explains that Israfel, the angel of healing, and then the angel of death who comes, Israel, he says these aren't angels. He says these are operative principles in the creation where Israfel, the bringer of life, Raphael, the angel Raphael, this is the power of composition. And that the angel death is really the act of decomposition. Mm-hmm. And so this is these operative principles behind the scenes were given symbolically as certain types of angels. There were seven of these named in this type of an explanation that are operative principles operating the reality behind the scenes. They're not actual people or beings that are like the seventh angel is man endowed with spiritual qualities and attributes. That's an actual angel. These were just used. When Muhammad says they don't have any free will, he's talking about the operative principles of reality that function behind the scenes. So the jinn is our genes or our genie. Well, the genes is where our genius comes from. So through our choices, we activate our true genius, and then we win our station and evolve. Well, in Greek and in Roman times, they had another word for our genius. It was called the daemon. And the daemon was the thing that governed our true genius. And the word daemon, Plato explains, means knowledge in ancient Greek or Rome. And it's in our word demonstrate. If you demonstrate, I have knowledge, well, demonstrate that to me. And they would do a demonstration. That's a demonstration. So yeah. The word genius comes from genie, or the jinn, mm-hmm. And this is the demon that governs our genius. These are the demons. And sometimes the word jinn is translated in the Quran as demons. Okay? And the demons are made of smokeless fire. That is, our genes show our geniuses. And of course, there's a such thing as satanic genius. Doc actually says that it was a stroke of satanic genius for Rui Kanum and them to do the switcheroo and accuse the firm to be covenant breakers, get everybody to shun the real ones. He called it a stroke of satanic genius. What's the third thing that you found recently about word activated? This one's interesting also.
This one I haven't looked into as deep, but I've worked with a woman who's a psychologist working with teen girls, and she's writing this book on this concept, but she sent me the paper from the scientific journal that like got her thinking about it, where this guy basically was saying that you know, the environment that we create and the words that we use to speak to like children and stuff like that can turn genes on and off by like influencing them with like words and environment and spirit. Like, you know, if there are kids raised in a spiritual environment, and you can turn on these spiritual genes, if they're raised in this other environment, you can turn them off. And, you know, it has to do, I don't think it's totally hammered out yet how they get turned on and off, but they're seeing that certain things can have a positive effect on this stuff.
And this is important. This is the nature-nurture argument when they were saying how much of a person's personality is environmental and how much is genetic. And some people didn't believe they interacted. And so this is going forward to prove that they interact. And I don't know why there was ever a debate on this. If you have a plant and you don't give it sunlight, it's not going to grow the same as if it is in the sunlight. It'll look different. So they knew that there were, even though it has a genetic predisposition to maybe be a great thriving plant, if it's in that type of environment, it you know, it doesn't reach its potential. It's also possible that its genetic structure is altered. They don't check the seeds to see if there's a genetic alteration. And God forbid they should start doing this, then they'll start reconstructing us, you know, with their monstrous barbarity, if they had this power over the DNA, you know, which they're trying to have now, like the mouse that had the ear on the back of it and some of these other barbarities. Now they want to put a piece of flesh. We're not going to have, inside of a phone and in the computer, we're not going to have a silicon chip, we're going to have a biochip. And it's going to be a piece of living, throbbing flesh that's at the center of all of our devices. It'll be in our car and on the laptop and the phone. This little piece of bloody, beating skin, and it'll have nerve endings on it, you know, and it'll be tied into the electronic device. And they want to implant these in our heads and stuff like this. Dan Rather talked about this on the news in the year 2000, and Colin was just telling me that they're already ready to move into biological storing of information on little pieces of flesh, you know. And so this is a concern. Now, you know, it might not be so bad if they stored this information in a plant and we could interface with like a piece of wood that was still alive or some little fungus that was growing, you know, or I don't know, something that looked nice, like a spore, I don't know. But if they move it into biological material, who wants to really have a cell phone that, you know, there's a little piece of flesh in there at the center of it? It's just a little bizarre. So in other words, as they do the human genome mapping, they'll start to discover where person's true genius is. If somebody votes Republican and their family's always voted Republican or always voted Democrat, they might discover a gene that causes them to do that. And then what if they genetically engineer us so we'll all vote that way? Well, we'll all march to Hitler. So this science is going to be protected from being known to the people until after the kingdom's established, and the future universal house of justice will have to make laws saying that this part of the DNA, you know, is sacrosanct. You're not going to experiment in that area. Now, if you want to get rid of sickle cell anemia or get rid of Down syndrome, that's in this part of the DNA, go ahead and experiment. But that this part here that relates to the core part of the spiritual personality, which is how the Holy Spirit is, the rays of the Holy Spirit accepted by the person, you're not to do that, you know. And of course, there'll be people that aren't going to obey. But at least it'll be outlawed by the civilization, you know, and so forth. Suppose they figure out how to take that DNA part and put it in a virus and then spread the virus. And instead of getting the flu and getting sick, you know, we get a flu, and at the end of the flu, we're a different person. All of a sudden, it's like, you know, what are you doing? I got to go vote Democrat. I got to go. I'm joining the Republican Party. Why? I don't know. You never did that before? Yeah, I don't know. I got this flu, and then I feel got over the flu, and just got to join the Tea Party. I got to join the Obamaites, you know. Why? I don't know. I got this urge, see. I mean, we all get genetic urges. We can't explain the natural ones that are helpful, like reproduction. That one's baffling enough.
Yeah.
That's a drive. They call it a sex drive. And we'll find our gene, and we'll have a political drive. We won't be able to stop. You know, I've got to pay, I want my taxes to double and pay this. You know, why? I don't know. I had the flu last week. You know, I just... And that's how they spread this stuff. They're able to empty out, they hollow out a virus, and then they put the new DNA in it, and then they inject it into the person, and it takes over the cell, and it removes the genetic abnormality on a cellular level. And this is for healthful purposes. And so this is in the Quran, in Surah of the Cow, chapter 2, 102. He says that there are these angels, Harut and Marut, which are two of the seven Zoroastrian archangels. So there are principles behind the scenes. And through them, knowledge, meaning, was sent down. This is the revelation of Zoroaster. And his priests were called the Magi. And so this is where they get the word magic from. And so, which is a foundation of science. And alchemy and Hermeticism, it's in Baha'u'llah's tablet of the Hikmat. And so people learn these secrets of creation. And once they had the knowledge to heal, they had the knowledge to kill. And once they had the knowledge to preserve, they had the knowledge to destroy. And Harut in the Zoroastrian language means wholeness. And Marut means immortality. So that through this knowledge, we have the knowledge of wholeness and immortality. And wholeness was symbolized by water. And the one of immortality, Marut, was symbolized by bread. And this is the bread and the wine. These two are symbolized of the Eucharist. And the reason is that it's the divine ether that Baha'u'llah says is the active and the passive, or the agent and the patient. And these two are one. That our actual Eucharist is the ether of the love of God. And let thy presence be my food. And so to those who understand will never hunger, Jesus says, I'm the bread who came from heaven. And those, and to drink is to believe. And what we drink or eat is this etherical substance, which is our rays of the Holy Spirit that creates our spiritual body in the next world. And we're dependent upon this. And these are the same things that cause electromagnetism and DNA. And they're based on the letters of the name of God in this science. And it's a puzzle that if they understood this, they'd be able to control all the forces of creation, like gods on earth, way more than they can now. And they're so corrupt and so abusive that it would be tremendously terrible. And that's why this cycle's coming to an end. They're going to be destroyed in the fire of their own making. And that's what Muhammad said. And he says, these jinn that were made from smokeless fire, their abode will be the fire when they choose to disobey God. And so through this science mentioned in Surah 2, 102, they've created the nuclear bomb. And they're going to a fire of their own making. And this jinn, this genetic strain, is what's going to be wiped out when two-thirds of mankind are killed. Anybody that has this gene is gone. Ah. And that though some of them that has it will at least repress it. And then it says Satan's put in a pit for 1,000 years, and then Satan himself will be thrown at the lake of fire. So in 1,000 years, even if it was repressed, it'll be removed from the genetic strain of the human race by the end of the 1,000-year period, and then it will be completely gone. Right? And Satan is the thing that activates, makes that a dominant gene, and it's represented by the two thrones in the earth. We have the throne of God, or YHVH, which it said Solomon inherited from David. Then Solomon sat on the throne of the Lord after his father David, YHVH. And then the other throne of Nimrod, and he said he was Saturn. And this was passed down up to, you know, the pederasts. And everywhere they brought that religion, darkness, you know, has covered the face of the deep. Pretty much, you know, the ignorance. For 2,000 years, they've been the most powerful, wealthiest institution in the world. Why is the world crap? if Shoghi, if Abdu'l-Bahá would have had the money and the resources, or Shoghi Effendi, that that church has, the world would be a paradise. How come when these institutions have control of that, or those people in this institution, the world is dark? Yeah. All right, well, Jesus said, I have many things to tell you now, but you cannot bear to hear them. But when he who is the Spirit of Truth comes, he will reveal unto the people all things. And this is fulfilled in Baha'u'llah, in his revelation. So they asked about, in this recent letter, about these secret societies and stuff. And I happened to be researching about the Masons and things. And so one of the things we see is that these revelations are given from the divine manifestation. And then right there at the feet of the promised one is the one waiting to receive the knowledge and immediately twisted and corrupted for themselves, what Doc explained. And sure enough, sitting at his feet were the members of that IBC that couldn't wait to hijack the revelation, substitute the administration for the faith, which Abdu'l-Bahá and Shoghi Effendi both said was can't substitute it. And then and we watched this happen in front of our eyes and lived through it. And because we believed in the rays of the Holy Spirit, you know, we felt the full impact of the forces of the entire 6,000-year Adamic cycle and those of the Baha'i cycle within this violation of the covenant that we experienced between the years 1996 and 2001. Just a short 5-year period. And that little 5-year period feels like 500,000 years. Now time seems to be flying by. But when I look back at the last 7 years, I'm like, wow, you know, they went by pretty fast. But when I look at those years, or even the 2 years between 96 and 98, those 2 years seem like 10,000 years. Why? It's because of the spiritual forces, the spiritual and psychological forces that are at work during the transition from the Adamic cycle proper to the Baha'i cycle proper of the 500,000-year cycle, and that violation. Like, we were instructed what happened when Christianity was hijacked. We understood how the Council of Nicaea was set up, and he explained how Nimrod and Semiramis were the arch-violators of the entire Adamic cycle, and how they hijacked every single one of the revelations. We even knew how the hands had broken the covenant in 57, and how we'd been plummeted into these world wars during the cycle due to the violations of the covenant. The center of the violation of Baha'u'llah and his covenant was based in the Ottoman Empire, where Abdu'l-Bahá was, and this was completely destroyed in World War I. And the center of violation against Shoghi Effendi was based in Dresden, Germany, during World War II. And this was the world's bombed out city in the war. And now we see the United States is the house of the center of the violation against the covenant of the true universal house of justice, which I don't understand how it survived at all between 91 and 2010, which is 19 years later. How it ever got up to this point and there's anybody left that could withstand these forces is unimaginable. And Shoghi Effendi talks about it in God Passes By. He says that the stress and the tests spiritually were devastating to just completely destroy anyone and everyone who said and professed belief in this, even if they were pure of heart. They wouldn't be able to withstand the tests and the trials because of the strenuousness of the forces unleashed during this time. And this is because of the collapse of one cycle and the ushering in of the new cycle. The people that will come in after the projection will be spared this transition. But when they come in, they have to come into the body of believers that's free from this altered problem. And this is the transition that we're in now. Well, we can see that each of the revelations have been hijacked. So Christianity isn't the true thing that Jesus revealed, obviously. And the mainstream Baha'i faith and Islam have gone askew. So on the Kabbalah tree, it shows the nine spheres being the nine manifestations, and they have this concept, which is that's the tree of life, which is called the tree of evil, the other tree. Baha'u'llah refers to it as the Zakkum tree. It's not the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's just a totally evil tree completely. There's no good on it at all. And so this Zakkum tree, instead of having Sephirot, which are these globes of light, it has what they call the ten clip-off or calipoth, but like you clip off your fingernail, clip off. This kind of sounds like that, and it means shells or husks, and it's what's left of where the revelation was once, but it's no longer there. Like if you eat a piece of corn, you're not going to eat the husk. It's like the rind of the, or the husk or the shell of what's left. And this is similar to a snake. When a snake grows, it sheds its skin and it moves on. And the other skin is all that remains. It looks just like the snake. I've seen a snake skin and thought it was a snake. You know, it even has the eyes. I don't know if they have skin on their eyes or something. But they seem to just shed the whole thing. And they just crawl out of its own mouth. See? Well, if you were to show up right at the point where it was finally about to leave, it would look like a snake biting its own tail. Get it? Because it's crawling out of its own skin. So it looks like one snake crawling out of the mouth of the other snake. And because it's the skin of the snake, it looks like two snakes. See? So this is the symbol of the Ouroboros. That's the snake biting its own tail. It's showing the cycle of how the snake leaves its own skin. And how this, and its reason it's a circle, sometimes it's two snakes. It'll be one snake biting the tail of another snake. Or sometimes it's only one snake biting its own tail. It's the cycle of the progression of the spirit from one place to another place. And the serpent is the symbol of the intellect. So as our intellect grows and evolves toward God, if we take the snake analogy, it's getting bigger. So its skin's too small for it. And that's why it sheds its skin and moves to the onward. Keeps doing this. I wonder how many times a snake will shed its skin in its lifetime. 7, 9, 20, who knows. Probably some number that's interesting. And this is what's left. So when we look at Christianity, what we're really looking at is snake skin. Jesus ain't there. There's that old joke, the black man's crying outside the church in Mississippi. He's out there and Jesus comes to him. He says, what's wrong? He says, they won't let me in there. You know? And he goes, oh, don't worry about it. They won't let me in there either. So, if this happens in the main revelations, well, it certainly happens in these societies. And so all of the revelations have had esoteric societies in them. For Islam, they have Sufis. The Jews have Kabbalists and Hasidics and stuff. And the Christians have had different groups. And among the Christian world that are most famous are like the Masons and the Rosicrucians and stuff like this. So these societies, at one point, within the dispensations, there's always been a true church. And then these will have breakaways, you know, as it happens. Like, for instance, in the Baha'i faith, we see that if we start with the Bab, when the Bab had died, the Babis broke into like 4 or 5 different sects. But one of them is where Baha'u'llah founds the Baha'i faith. So when he passed on, or ascended, Abdu'l-Bahá succeeded in the covenant, but Muhammad Ali said they were the true Baha'is. And the people who reckon themselves to be Baha'is were the greatest persecutors of Abdu'l-Bahá. And he talks about this in The Last Tablet to America. Well, then when Shoghi Effendi succeeds, there were several sects that broke in opposition to Shoghi Effendi, all saying they accepted the Bab and Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá. Whereas Muhammad Ali's group said they accepted the Bab and Baha'u'llah, but not Abdu'l-Bahá. So these accepted them, but not Shoghi Effendi. And so on with Mason and Pepe, and then it comes down today. And the successorship is a sign of the of those that break out in schism. But it's not the it's not the source of the rays of the Holy Spirit. It's the sign of where we can recognize that those outside of it are in the schism. And this is what Muhammad says in the Quran, in chapter 22, he says, behold, the unbelievers, they are an open schism.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Open schism?
Yeah. He says, you can see the disbelievers, they're an open schism. That's their punishment. Ah! Open schism means here's the explicit text of the covenant, and they are just in schism against it. There they are, you can see them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. I'd never seen that before. So here they were trying to say the Baha'i faith had broken into schisms like every other religion. But that's not even what Muhammad says. He says, behold, their disbelievers are an open schism against what the document says. So this is kind of how we're able to stay current. So current, like a current event, means what's happening now, but it's also the word we use for electric current. So in other words, we receive our rays of the Holy Spirit because we keep current. And when Doc was practicing, he said he had to keep current all the time. They had these medical magazines that he'd keep getting, so he'd be able to keep current with the science, because the science keeps progressing every day. And so we have to keep current with this. But religion stops progressing. They created a doctrine or a dogma, and they say that's true. Then something comes along that contradicts that, and they won't accept it. Except the thing that's contradicting it is Jesus, that's telling them something that was different than what they think Moses was actually getting at. And it happens within the dispensations. It's progressive. So we're not just Baha'is under the covenant because we believe in some sort of a doctrine. The unifying principle for the dead religions is doctrine or dogma. We're the Baptists. Oh, thought you were Christian. No, we're not Christian. We're Baptist. Well, anyway, what does it mean to be Baptist? Well, when you're an adult, you've got to get baptized, and then you're saved. He says, well, what about if you're a baby? He says, no, babies don't get baptized. Well, we're Methodist. Okay, I thought you were Christian. No, we're not Christian. We're Methodist. What does that mean? Well, you don't just get baptized once. You get baptized periodically if you fall back and get rebaptized, you know. So this is why they unite around each other, you know. Well, what are you? We're Seventh-day Adventists. What does that mean? We're vegetarians. We don't work on Saturday. That's what we do. See what I mean? So they're grouped around what they do and what they believe. Well, if your unity comes to you from what you do and what you believe, well, then you can never change what you do, and you can never change what you believe, because if you change what you do and you change what you believe, you're no longer part of the group, because you're doing something different and you believe something different. So now you're excommunicated or separate or something like that. Now, if your point of unity is you're a human being, and just because you're human, you're part of the group, well, then it doesn't matter what you do and what you believe. You can evolve and change in a positive direction. And so we don't have a dogma or a doctrine of belief. Well, the word king comes from the word kin, kinship. It's just a symbol of the unity of the family of mankind. So it's not an acceptance of a doctrine or a dogma or the mindset of an individual. This is the worst thing that can happen to somebody. I'd say it's worse than indoctrination. It's not only being indoctrinated, but where you're trapped in the mindset of some one person. Like Scientology or, you know, Appliantology or something like that, whatever. Mindhead. Yeah. You know? I mean, it's bad enough that we kind of live in the mindset of our parents to a certain extent.
Or the mindset of our three-year-old self that is hanging on something or whatever it is.
Yeah. And so one of my goals is to break free of these mindsets. I'd like to see reality, you know. Now I recognize I get trained in a school of thought, like looking at the world through Einstein's theories is kind of looking at it through his mindset, you know. And so I can accept that, but he's wrong in a few areas. That's where science is going to expand. So we have to be careful about this. So this covenant frees us from that. What it shows is our unity is as a people and not as a doctrine or a dogma or a mindset. So we're free of this. Well, these other things aren't free of it. So anyway, the way they were set up, this guy wrote in about this, this gets back to the Masons, is that they had three orders traditionally in Christianity, maybe in Sufism and Judaism too. And the first group was the outer order of the esoteric society. And this is the name that the people would know the outer order by. And then if they joined this order, they'd be indoctrinated in a certain way, and then they would have a second order. The second order was the inner circle, and this is what was governing the inner order. And sometimes nobody knew who was in the second order or what the second order was up to. They were just aware of the first order. So sometimes people didn't even know there was a second order. Well, not only that, there was a third order. And the third order was the actual source of the government of the second order that outwardly they had the first order. And most of the people in the second order had no idea who was in the third order. And the outer head of the order was usually the highest member in the second order. And that the people that were, wherever this was coming from in the third order, there was a secret. And so they variously called the third order the Ascended Masters, the hidden teachers, the secret chiefs,
yeah,
or the hidden brotherhood, or the great white brotherhood, and they have these various names. And some people went so far as to suggest they were the ascended masters, or like Jesus and Muhammad and Buddha. That's who's actually in the third order. So now we're looking at, well, they're not even material. They exist in a spiritual realm, not in the material world, and this is the governing authority, which is the inner order. Okay, and then in the Sufis call these men, these people, the men of the unseen, or the Rijal al-Ghaib, or the Rijal, or the Ali Ghaib, the people of the unseen, or the Rijal, the men of the unseen. Rijal doesn't just mean men, it kind of means something else. It, like the star Rigel means feet, it means like leader, or walking, or our feet are understanding, you know. So Shoghi Effendi explains that when Baha'u'llah was in Soleimani, and he was he was in exile during those 2-year period, that the different people in that area recognized him as one of the men of the unseen, you know, or the secret chiefs. And it so happens that during this period between 1844 and 1863, after this, we see Gurdjieff, the Masonic revival. We see the formation of the Theosophic Society. Rudolf Steiner broke away from that. He was a Theosophist, became an Anthroposophist. And then we see the and he formed the Waldorf schools. And then we see the coming of these different groups and organizations in like this Renaissance era time in the Western esoteric tradition. Abdu'l-Bahá met with Annie Besant and wrote a tablet about some of the things that the Theosophists were doing, and so forth. Well, the Theosophists are another one of these groups. You've got the Theosophical Society, then you have the Inner Circle, and then they claimed that they were in contact with the Hidden Masters. And they named them like Dwaj, Ghul, and other things like, you know, these crazy names. You know, what are they talking about? Well, Gurdjieff said he went and studied with the Sarmang Brotherhood, which historians have tracked down to being the Naqshbandi Sufi order, which is where Baha'u'llah was staying. And Gurdjieff's, yeah, and Gurdjieff's obsessed with the number 9. Well, when we look at the Freemasons, the Freemasonic Order, one of their orders of the Royal Scot Order is a 9-pointed star. And this 9-pointed star is formed of 3 triangles, and it's in the Masonic Temple in Washington, D.C., where the stellar alignment is given. So some of these people were persecuted by the church. Like the Catholic Church was absolutely against the Masons for a long time. Well, the Masons traced their history back to 1717 when the British Lodge incorporated itself in London. And before that, they can't really explain who they are or what their history is. Well, in Yeats' book, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment and Occultism in the Elizabethan Age, she talks about how Shakespeare and the British society, this is when Britain was becoming a world power, right before the time of Isaac Newton, was somehow tapped in to this secret knowledge and wisdom. And this is when we see the Masons actually were in existence, between the years 1300 AD to 1600 AD. During like a 200 or 300 year period, they weren't known at all. And they were the outer order. And then the second order governing them was Christian Rosicrans, the Rose Cross, or the Rosicrucians. This was their second order. And the third order was the Secret Chiefs. And this goes back to the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar left France in 1309 about AD, and half of them went to Portugal, half of their fleet. And they believe the other half of the fleet went up to Scotland, where the Edinburgh is, and where Rosalind Chapel was established. They had a refuge in Scotland from that. And that after that, the Masons came out of their order, and that the order behind the Knights Templar, which was the outer order, was again the Rosicrucians, if you wanted to give them a name. So the second order had changed its outer name a couple of times, maybe changed its inner name. But the third inner order was the Secret Chiefs. And this guy wrote in and he says, well, you know, we're not supposed to join these secret organizations, yet a lot of the Baha'i writings seem to have explanations about this esoteric knowledge. You know, how do you explain that? Well, it's not that the knowledge is secret. What was kept a secret was if you were a member of these groups, you didn't tell anybody, A, and B, you didn't know who the leadership was. It was a secret. It was the Secret Chiefs. Well, why? Well, they were killing and persecuting anybody. If anybody was known to be a member of these type of things, they'd lose their job, they'd be put to death, they'd run out of... Look what happened to Jesus and Socrates. Socrates had to drink hemlock, and when he went public, and Jesus was crucified. So they felt it was better just not to have to get into what it was they really believed in and who they were really working for. And, of course, they did believe they were working for God and that they were being governed through receiving rays of the Holy Spirit. And Jesus had already come and gone. They were in the middle of the Christian dispensation that they knew Christ would come again. Well, they had a different belief than the general people. They believed, like the Jewish literature says, that not that Jesus would come down out of the sky in a cloud, but there was a throne line of King David that was being passed down from father to son. And when pressed on this issue, they came up with this story that Jesus and Mary Magdalene, you know, had some sort of a lineage, you know, or something. When really some of the founders of their order were from Jesus' brother James that went up into Europe. And so they weren't of the throne line because Jesus and Mary Magdalene didn't have any children, you know. But this was just how this was being persecuted by the other main groups. Well, Shakespeare was part of this. And in his book, Hamlet, at the very end, you ever see the end of Hamlet? Everybody kills everybody. You know, in the middle of it, he's like, to be or not to be. Well, by the time the end of the play comes up, his mother's killed herself. He stabbed his uncle. He's been stabbed. And you look at the stage, everybody's laying around. They're dying. Ugh. Like 10 of the main characters just all laying there stabbed and bleeding to death. And then this other guy runs into the stage, you know, in the middle of this. And they sent out two messengers to get help earlier. And he busts in the room and he goes, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, you know, which is these two other minor characters. And so people are like, what's Shakespeare talking about? Is this overkill? Here's this scene where everybody's dead and dying. And then on top of it, these two characters that had like two lines in the beginning, they're like, oh, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, go out and do this. And they're like, yes, so they leave. So at the very end of the play, this other character runs and you don't even see them again. And he just announces that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. And then the curtain drops and the play ends and everybody dies. It's an interesting play. Well, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is the Stone Guild. And Rosencrantz is, these are weird names, is Christian Rosencrantz. So in 1600 AD, when the play Hamlet was sent out, Shakespeare's announcing that the First Order of the Stonemasons and the Second Order of the Rose Cross are already dead. Defunct. Hijacked. They're like BS corrupt organizations. And those things have been wrong since Shakespeare published that play. But he also assured everybody that a rose is a rose by any other name. See? Meaning that the truth of Christianity, and Baha'u'llah referred to this rose of the letter H and the coming of the second coming of Christ, is preserved, you know, but not in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, not in the Masons, and not in the in the other order. Well, this eventually, at that time, they had already been relocating to the United States. That they had not only gone up into Scotland in this area, but they kind of moved their operation to the United States. Eric the Red had been here earlier, and they believed that Henry Sinclair, that was up in Scotland, had already come to Nova Scotia, which means New Scotland, by 1600 or so, before Columbus. Columbus came here in 1492. They believe they were already up there in the 1300s. So by the 1600s, this was when America had already been found and it was being resettled here, and that this thing in England, and that it was over, you know, and so forth. Well, these things have been hijacked by these international bankers and these different groups. So when these groups built Washington here, they were already another order. And I think this is when the name Illuminati started to be used at some point as a name for the outer order of the thing. And they built Washington, D.C. in this way because they knew that the kingdom would eventually be established here in America. And these are the type of things that Dan Brown and these other ones like National Treasure are popularizing at this time. But they haven't recognized the throne line is from the Exilarchs, which is Baha'u'llah. They haven't recognized Ezekiel's temple isn't built in Washington, but it's in the treasure state. But they must have known it was going to be up there because they called it the treasure state. Like they called Philadelphia, the Keystone State. And the National Treasure, they even said in one of these documentaries, isn't physical property. They said it was the knowledge of the truth, some sort of secret knowledge that was known. So I wrote to this person, I said, well, the reason we're not a secret society is we'll tell you who the Third Order is, you know, or we don't have secret chiefs. We have a covenant that explicitly tells us this is Baha'u'llah, and this is Abdu'l-Bahá, and the people that are against it are in open schism. And we're not afraid to drink the cup of hemlock or go to the cross or be shot with 750 rifle rounds. We're not keeping this secret from our neighbors. And because of the United States having these laws of the separation of church and state, which were the basic concepts that these people saw, like when the Knights Templar were put to death, it was for heresy. They wanted to build a government where when this thing came forward, it wouldn't be persecuted by the state, but actually have semi-protection under it. And that's what we have here at the United States at this time. So that kind of sums it up. Well, the stuff just stops. It's really weird. I wrote the letter to the guy, and it was kind of like that. And then the letter just ended. I just sat there. You know, what's going on now? Click, click. Time to spell check. Just comes to an end, doesn't it? Just like, whoop.
That was fast.
Yeah, the ends are fast.
Do you want to? I found the guy's book.
Mind over matter. Yeah.
If you guys want to hear a quote from the source.
Yeah, let's read a quote. What's the name of the source and everything?
This is from a book by John Arden and Lloyd Linford, and they're kind of the ones that are promoting this idea. Let's see. Recent science suggests an ubergenetic or epigenetic system that changes in response to environmental exposure, e.g. to famine.
This could be what the what we were calling it, meta-DNA. They were calling it junk, and then it was called something else.
Yeah, that's what these guys are referring to, is that meta-DNA.
Oh, they're actually specifically saying it's that DNA.
Yeah.
Do they call it meta-DNA, or what are they calling it?
They kind of go in this scientific thing where they kind of break it down, and then he says that the...
Well, go ahead and read the quote. I want you to clear that up in my head.
Anyways, that the epigenetic system that changes in response to environmental exposure, e.g. to famine, and has the power to switch the expression of specific genes on or off. Although the percentage varies widely depending on the precise gene, roughly speaking, genes control about 50% of the variance in most traits.
And these are like personality traits, introversion, extroversion. When they say traits, they just don't mean like brown eyes, blue eyes. You're talking about personality traits too.
Yeah, right. Like he goes on to say,
what we might be talking about is that stuff that geneticists are saying is junk DNA, and they really don't know what it is, but it could have more to do with personality traits and the kind of thing that you've been addressing.
Yeah, that we were calling it meta-DNA, meaning it's the DNA that controls and turns on and off the other DNA. Because they've had research that showed that some of that DNA was controlling the other genes. And that's what these guys are saying, too. So they don't call it junk. They call it non-coded DNA, meaning they haven't coded it. I didn't like that word. We started calling it meta. You know, the idea that metaphysics governs the physics.
Mm-hmm.
We were calling it meta-DNA, the idea that that DNA governed the other DNA.
Oh, so you coined that.
Yeah. But this is what they're talking about. They're calling it what? Epigenetic.
Or ubergenetic.
Uber. Yeah, I don't care for that. I call it metagenetic.
Meta sounds pretty good.
Well, metaphysics to physics, meta-DNA to DNA. Uber is too German for me, but whatever.
Oh, what he's saying is that the chemical regulators of the DNA form an epigenetic system.
Yeah, that's true.
That determines what role, if any, a particular gene will have.
That's the stuff they've already discovered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's quoting, like, previous studies.
So it's meta-DNA or epigenetic. Those are good words. He's coining uber-DNA. But see, it's the same thing we've been talking about here at the forum for a few months now.
Someone's chiming in. Oh, so Kevin posted this long thing about the chimps way back when.
Okay.
So he was reminding me to mention that.
Yeah, I should find that science article on the chimps. The chimps.
Okay, so Kevin says, I think the chimps are beginning to reflect the worst human behaviors, even without ever having observed those human behaviors. The Indian elders used to tell me that nature would begin to demonstrate the lowest human behaviors when the big earth changes were about to occur. Hence these chimps being like this all the way to the weather changes and the violence in the atmosphere. And then eventually we'll behave so badly that we'll call the asteroid to us. So that the chimps being so like us, and pretty much the next level down from us. Plus when Doc said that in a literal physical kingdom we'll have no noxious plants or animals. The Indian elders always said
for every species we lost from our bad behaviors, we finally get back two for each one that are beneficial and beautiful, but not till after the two-hearted ones, bad people, have been taken away by the Creator, or rather by their own bad behaviors.
Did you want to read more from that article?
No, not really.
So epigenetic systems is what they're saying.
Yeah, and this is their like mainstream book on how to implement it. It's not really their scientific study. But
okay.
What's the name of the book?
This book is called Brain-Based Therapy with Adults, Evidence-Based Treatment for Everyday Practice.
By who?
John Arden and Lloyd Linford.
Okay. Thanks.
But what chapter is that other thing in? Because what pages were you reading from?
Oh, that quote. This is from the introduction.
Oh, the introduction. Okay.
Yeah.
They probably have a chapter on it in there.
Yeah. Well, their whole thing is they're kind of going through this, in this book, from what I just skimmed, is that they're going through this idea of, like, psychotherapy and, like, how it developed and Freud and his whole thing and how there's kind of been this conflict between psychotherapy and like neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
And so these guys are saying that their goal, they kind of want to bridge some of these new developments in like neuroscience and genetics and apply it to Freudian-based psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And how to, so that's where their whole thing of like, you know, controlling this environment to turn these genes on and off,
mm-hmm,
is kind of where they're based in like a therapeutic session.
Mm-hmm. It's really true that if people are raised in the ghetto, he says, in the inner city, they have to take on animal traits to survive. It's not conducive for them to have spiritual behaviors because they'll be just destroyed. Like, you have to defend yourself and protect yourself and be territorial. But he says if you change that environment, then they'll have the chance to become, to cultivate the spiritual part of their personality.
Mm-hmm.
We have those ghettos so they'll join the army.
Right.
Because we're the defenders of the European and other safe havens that don't have to pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we're here. He says the manifestations always come to the darkest place in the world. So you had the high priest of the manifestation, the great establisher, be up in Montana, you know. And that's got a really primitive government up there.
Yeah.
Like compared to like Rhode Island or New York or California or other places. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes on. There's just swept under the rug and the light's not shining on it. And there's good people up there, too. But if you get a corrupt one in a government post up there, they do whatever they want. The state's run by a real tight clique.
Mm.
Not that the other ones aren't completely, but they've got so many different things happening with these, what are they called, interest groups or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
And that they shine the light.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's what Geraldo used to say he liked to do. He used to say, like, to shine the light and watch the roaches scurry away. But he started out like that. Muckraker. The muckrakers were good. They, right. That means you rake the muck out of the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Yellow journalism was the negative. I had the two things confounded when I was 19, but
oh,
then I found out they were different. The muckrakers cleaned up the meatpacking industry in Chicago. That's why they're called muckrakers.
Upton Sinclair and all that?
Yeah, Upton Sinclair. They were the Chicago. When we were in Chicago and we took a tour, a boat tour of the city, they told us about it, that the you've got the Lake Michigan there,
mm-hmm,
and the river was actually flowing out of Chicago into the lake.
Mm.
So they had to do this thing to cause the lake to flow into Chicago down the river. I don't know what they did. They might have a lock. I think they have some sort of a thing there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, all the meatpacking plants were on the river outside of Chicago, and so this was all going into the river. And something happened where it flowed the wrong way at some point because of a flood or, I don't know, a rain or some of the story. But there was like, the whole river was all bloody and went the other way out into the Lake Michigan. And it was just disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, the muckrakers cleaned up all that.
Yeah.
And then they, because everybody knew what was going on, there was such a public outcry, they were forced to change it. And at some point, people are going to be, why is life so terrible? Why is our civilization so repressive? Why don't I have all these benefits? Why is my church so corrupt? Why are the priests in the church and my preacher and minister corrupt? Why is all this happening? Why? And then they'll find out that known or not, they were no longer in harmony with the one true invisible God.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll realize the source of the problem. And then that's when they'll switch. Because they won't want to be part of it. all the Jews were pagans. They had statues of the kings on the mountains. They were worshiping Ashtoreth and Milcom. They were, had the same religion as the nations. They were still killing their babies at the time of Jeremiah in the fires of Moloch. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's like 700 BC. I mean, that's way, that's 700 years after Moses. If you read the scriptures, it's, this is all in there. So then the temple had fallen apart. And so the king was a good king. He ordered that the temple should be refurbished. The doors were actually falling off it. Nobody even went in there. This was Solomon's temple. Mm-hmm. So they went in there, and then one of the priests came to the king, and he says, we found this moldy old book, you know, while we were renovating the temple. He says, well, what is it? He says, I don't know. It's in five parts. And they opened it up, and it was the five books of Moses. They hadn't even read it. Like, what's this say? And then he read through the thing, and he saw the Moloch and the laws of Moses and how he condemns the false religion. He talks about Nimrod and Babylon and that. And they were like, oh, my God. He says, we're in complete violation of the covenant. The curse of Moses is upon us. No wonder this is so terrible. And he ordered that the whole thing be cleaned up. He had all the statues of the Ashtoreth and them, where they used to go and worship them, he turned it into a public urinal. So they'd go there and urinate where they used to go and worship these pagan statues, you know. And, yeah. And so then they cleaned up the whole thing, and they had like a little renaissance or an enlightenment. And this was at the time of Socrates. Yeah. And it was after this cleanup act that we see this resurgence in Greece, you know, with the coming of Socrates and these ones. But it had waned from the time of Solomon until then.
Who did that, Jeremiah?
I think Josiah.
Josiah.
Yeah, King Josiah, yeah. Mm. Yeah, he was a good king.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the cleanup. And then they had a bad king after that. And they were even worse than they were before. And then Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed them. So, you know, why would God allow Nebuchadnezzar to destroy them if they're the chosen people?
Right.
So this country, you know, is going to be hit hard in this war. And they'll be like, well, if we were the chosen nation and the pride of the... Why have we been hit so hard? Well, they weren't right by God, you know. God still let the Jews rebuild their civilization after that, but then they didn't accept Jesus. And then they were completely wiped out. And these people are guilty of both things at once. They not only have the triune God lie, the incarnate God lie that caused Nebuchadnezzar to destroy them, but they have the rejection of Baha'u'llah, which caused Titus to destroy them. So they're in for a double whammy. They don't think it's spiritually oriented. They think that they're free of superstition and voodoo and myth, and that there isn't a spiritual reality, and that therefore they can do whatever they want and not reap any repercussion. Mm-hmm. If you read Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from the Birmingham jail, in that he explains there's a moral order to the universe, and that slavery is immoral, so it's against this, and therefore it's destined to be removed. And that was the first time I ever understood like morality. Mm-hmm. Like they teach a class in morals and ethics, mm-hmm. and to me it was always, I don't mean I didn't know what was moral, but I mean I didn't understand what they were teaching or trying to get at in a moral and ethics class. It just seemed like a bunch of words. When I read what he said about it, I immediately understood the whole thing. Mm-hmm. That's when I was like, oh, this is what he's saying.
Like a universal harmony type of a thing or something.
Yeah, there's not only a scientific design in the creation, but this is expressed morally. It's the reason the design of the creation is the way it is because it's essentially moral. Mm-hmm. And the ether isn't just the power for electricity and magnetism. Magnetism is the power of attraction. So that's love in the mineral level. So this ether is the moral underpinning of it. It's the source of how we know and love God. So it becomes our food and drink, like on this level, you know. This is the fabric. It's a moral fabric. Okay. And that's why, you know, if they cross that line, you know, then they're in breach of the entire life design.
Right.
Yeah. You can't have science and immorality. Especially now, we'll live on the island of Dr. Moreau, and all these secret societies aren't secret. And you've got these cabals of people with the money financing cloning now. They want to live for Earth forever, so they're going to make clones of themselves and then remove the brain from the clone and transplant their brain out of their body into the clone body.
Hey, that's just wacky.
So basically, they're going to make another person and kill it. Mm-hmm. And put their brain into that brain. Or their brain into that new clone body of themselves.
Yeah.
And who'd want to be here forever anyway?
Not me.
So you can eat more shrimp
cocktail.
Well,
you don't want to let all that wealth go.
You know, that's a good point. If you know that you're in store for absolutely nothing but hellfire in the next world, maybe you would want to stay on Earth as long as possible.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Why else wouldn't they want to go over there? A, they love everything here. B, there's nothing for them there. C, if there is something for them there, it's punishment. So they'll just like live like demons on Earth forever. Hmm. Even if they did that, they're not going to live that much longer. The brain itself will disintegrate. I bet the brain is what was killing those people that lived to be 1,000.
I bet that's wearing out.
Yeah, I bet the actual place where the soul shines in the brain or whatever disintegrates. You know, because the brain's made out of fatty oils. I bet the brain's designed to outlive the body. So if you remove the, what are those called? The cosmic rays that cause aging, like when we had the crystal veil.
UVs.
Yeah, the UVs and all of those things, that the body wasn't affected, right? And then I bet at a certain point your brain just goes, that one spot, you know, and then the connection's broken. Which means that even if they did clone these bodies, they wouldn't live more than 1,000 years anyway.
Right.
But still, 1,000 years of these people, while we were living to be 70.
Yeah, they would just... Oh, it just sounds hellish.
It's already hellish. If we could see things for what they really were like, it would be way worse than we see them now.
I know.